Well, I'm joined today by Neil Dring, who is the senior solicitor from Jones Myers in Harrogate. Welcome back, Neil. It's great to see you.
Looking forward to having a chat.
And tell us all about Jones Myers.
Well, Jones Myers are a specialist firm of solicitors, and we only deal with divorce and separation cases. We don't deal with anything else at all. We are based in Leeds, is our head office. We have offices in Harrogate and York as well. We not only specialise in divorce and family cases, but we have individual lawyers within each office who specialise either in financial cases, which is what I do, also specialise in children's cases. We have a specialist team of child lawyers and a specialist team of financial lawyers, so that all clients will get the best advice on their specific area of difficulty.
My first question is, why the question? Why wouldn't everything be 50-50? Where does the question come from, Neil?
Well, the question comes from a meeting I had recently with some friends and colleagues who are not lawyers. And one of them had spoken to a friend, a colleague of his, who'd been through a divorce. And so he was asking, if you like, on behalf of a friend, literally in that case, why is everything not divided 50-50? They didn't understand. And it just seemed to be something that a lot of people will want to know the answer to. I mean, we lawyers do it all every day. We know the reasons. It's an assumption for us, but not for normal people who are not lawyers.
And let's start with children in that, and dividing 50-50 in terms of a child's time is what we mean by 50-50.
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, first of all, when we are looking at finances, we take into account all of the circumstances. And one of the circumstances of the case will be where the children are living, who they're living with, and what their housing needs are. So it's vitally important then to just take a step back and think about that and decide whether the time that the children spend with each parent should be divided 50-50 or not. And there is no assumption that that would be the case, because every single case is different. But when we think about it logically, before people separate, when we're living together perfectly happily, we don't divide the time that we spend with the children 50-50. We have our way of running our lives, running our homes. One parent might be working from home. One parent might not go out to work at all, might spend all day at home with the children. The other parent might go out to work, long hours, early in the morning, late at night, weekends, night shifts. And so essentially, despite the fact that they are sharing care of the children, sharing responsibility, and they're sharing the roles that they play, they're not actually dividing the time that they spend with the children, because that's not the way normal people live their lives. So if that's not the way we deal with it before separation, why would it be the way that we deal with it after separation? And the important thing to bear in mind is that on separation, the children are not belongings. They're not things that we own to be divided between us. And the important factor is not what's right for you as a parent or what's right for me as a parent, but what's right for the children. It's their welfare, their best interests is the only and the guiding factor. And if that means that they will spend most of their time living with one parent, and sometime, a bit less time perhaps, living with the other parent, maybe at weekends or overnights through the week, sharing time in holidays, that's what it means. That's not to detract from shared parental responsibility, shared care. We both care for our children in exactly the same way. It's just that the time that we spend with them is not always going to be 50-50 and shared equally.
And what advice would you give to adults going into those kind of conversations? What advice would you give to people who are going to be starting to have these chats and take into the account all the things you're talking of?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head in the question, really. Adults, behave like an adult. You put aside your ego, put aside your feelings of any animosity or whatever it might be. Put aside your fears of fearing that you might not be spending as much time with children, and focus entirely on what's best for them. And then when you do spend your time with the children, make the most of that rather than regretting the fact that your former partner might have an extra day or more time with them. Focus on the needs of the children rather than on what your own aspirations or needs might be.
Okay, let's move on to some other things here. So when we talk about why isn't it a simple 50-50 split, I completely get that children, it's far more complicated, and everything you've said makes perfect sense, Neil, as it always does. But when we get into finances, there might well be people who just assume that, yeah, why wouldn't you just cut it all down the middle? And why isn't that just the standard way of doing things?
Well, in a sense, the starting point is that it is the standard way of approaching it in the beginning. It's not always the way it ends up because of things I'll move on to now, but that's where we start from. So in a long marriage, where there are children, where we've built up our home and our assets and our savings, our investments together during the course of that marriage, the starting point is to think, okay, well, what will happen if we do divide those assets equally between us? How will that impact on each of us and our ability then to live and maintain our standard of living thereafter? What we do is we take all of the circumstances into account and then decide what is fair financially to both parents. But in particular, first consideration has to be given to the financial needs and the welfare of the children, and therefore, there's a link into what we've just said, of the parent with whom the children are spending most of their time. And especially, consideration has to be given to the housing needs of those children to make sure they've got a safe and secure home to live in that is reasonable and appropriate for their needs. So that's the starting point.
And it's starting to make more sense now, because if you're kind of working everything through a filter that starts from the family, from the children, well, as it filters down, the next conversations, the next decisions are based on the first stage of talking about the needs of the children.
Well, absolutely right. So if we just look at some examples, as I say, the starting point is that those joint assets that we build up together during the marriage are divided equally. Now, that includes assets that they might be in your sole name, they might be my sole name, they might be in joint names. But if we build them up together jointly, whoever's name they're in is irrelevant. They're considered as being joint matrimonial property. So we think, okay, let's divide those 50-50. What will that do? In some situations, that will be the answer because, for example, let's just think we've got two people who are both working. You earn $30,000 a year. I've earned $40,000 a year. We live in a £1 million house with no mortgage. Well, we can divide that 50-50, take £500,000 each. We can then buy a mortgage-free property suitable for our needs with a small mortgage if we want to, and we can maintain that and live off that, and that's no problem. So in that situation, with those simple facts, that would be a case where a 50-50 share would work. But let's just change that a little bit. If the house is worth £500,000 instead, with a mortgage of £200,000, I don't go out to work or I work part-time. I earn £15,000 a year. You earn £100,000 a year. If we divide that house 50-50, I get £150,000 with minimal, very little mortgage capacity. I can't buy a house for myself and for the three children who live with me. So I need a bigger share of that house in order to meet my housing needs and, in particular, the housing needs of the children. You, on the other hand, could take a smaller share of the house, have a smaller deposit to put down on the house, but you've got a much greater income, you can get a much bigger mortgage, so we can end up living in the same sort of property, you with a large mortgage and a small deposit, me either mortgage-free or with a very, very small mortgage and a larger deposit, and we're both meeting our housing needs and we can afford that, and that's fair.
I think the other bit, obviously, that I'm picking up on from how you're talking and what you're talking about, Neil, is that it's not a straight cut. It's also about looking to what your life looks like. So part of where you move forward is because of children or because of other parts of the situation, you need to live in such a way. That's taken into consideration.
Right.
So it's very grey, isn't it? It's less black and white than maybe we realise.
No, it is kind of grey, but there's bits of definition in there. You've got to look at all of the circumstances. There's no specific rule that says this is what you do in this situation. The law literally says you look at all of the circumstances and do what is fair to both parties. That has a huge, broad discretion. Mm. Which means that you can have two situations where two people living more or less next door to each other with very similar families, but one tiny difference in their financial circumstances might mean that the outcome in one situation could be very different from the outcome in the other. Just going on from what we were saying about the house, that was a simple situation where the house is the only asset. What we also try and do is make sure that's fair as well. So that, for example, if we're going to sell the house or even transfer the house into one person's sole name so that the larger wage earner might get less than 50% of the house. Well, if there are also investments or particularly pensions, then what we might do, bearing in mind that those things have to be divided equally as well, what we might do is decide instead of having the half share of the house, the larger wage earner might keep a larger share of the pensions because the parent with the children, their immediate needs are focusing on housing for themselves and for the children and paying the bills and being able to stay in that house. Their immediate needs are not necessarily on the pensions in 20 or 30 years' time. So what we can do to try and make it fair is have let the other party keep a larger share of other assets in return, offsetting in return for keeping a smaller share of the house. We have to be careful as well because that's not to ignore the fact that in the future that parent with the children will have pension needs. So we've got to also look forward to think, well, how can those be met in the future? But the housing needs of the children will be the important factor. So we can offset by having different shares of other assets that the other parent can retain, or sometimes them not paying as much maintenance. The maintenance obligation perhaps might be reduced in return for the fact that they've had to take on a larger mortgage to buy a similar property.
So if we can come back to maintenance, but on pensions, if you're working age or, you know, small children age, that can seem a way off. And also, I suppose it can just not be front of mind for people.
Right. Yeah.
But actually, in terms of what a couple have, it's very significant, isn't it?
It certainly can be, particularly in long marriage cases. It's a factor that we have to take into account because in a lot of cases now where people may have been married for 10, 15, 20 years or more, a pension might be at least the second biggest asset that the family own together, if not the largest asset that they have. And in many, many situations, what we end up not doing necessarily is simply saying, well, look, I'm having 2/3, 3/4, whatever it is of the house, and therefore I shan't have any pension claim at all. You look at it much more carefully than that. The figures have to stack up and not just be a broad guess of what might be fair settlement. So you look at the pension assets, decide what would be a fair, equal division of the pension, and then compare that to the offsetting that you're giving by one of the parents retaining a larger share of the house. And in some situations, it may well be that that means that they don't have any retained pension share at all. They then do have that worry in the future about how they will provide for their pension. The answer to that is going to be to look at a financial advisor, perhaps try to start making provision for pension, but also maybe at some point in the future downsizing and putting a lump sum into a pension scheme. But occasionally what we have is a situation where it isn't a case of giving up all of your pension claim, but having a reduced pension share. So instead of having half of the house and half of the pension, you might end up having a much larger share of the house and maybe only 25% of the pension as something to be working on for the future. And then later on, you can add to that when the children are older by going out to work and making your own pension contributions or making additional pension contributions, or at some future point, again, perhaps downsizing and putting a lump sum into the pension scheme.
And can you explain maintenance to me?
Maintenance is a complicated issue. There are two aspects of maintenance. One is going to be, if there are children, then the parent with whom the children spend most of their time living will be entitled to claim child support maintenance. Now, if necessary, that can be done through the Child Maintenance Service, what used to be called the CSA. You can go online and Google that and work out what the figure should be. Or the better way of going about it is to do that inquiry online and then just agree with each other, that's how much we're going to pay in child maintenance. The next question then is whether the higher wage earner should, in addition to child maintenance, should in addition to that, should pay some kind of maintenance, spousal maintenance, to the other party who earns less money. And that depends upon whether they have the need for that maintenance in order to meet their bills and their expenses and their financial needs. Now, it's fair to say that in a long marriage situation, and very often maintenance will be paid, but there's no assumption that it will be paid, particularly if we're doing what we're talking about here, and that is unequal divisions of the property and assets. In those situations, we'll always have a duty to see whether we can put into effect a clean break, so there'll be no maintenance pay going forward. And that would work, for example, if the smaller wage earner has a smaller mortgage or no mortgage at all, the other one has a much bigger mortgage they have to fund from their higher income. It could be that a spousal maintenance clean break will work there. Very often, if there are children, you have a sort of a situation where we were going to have a clean break, but not straight away. Because the idea might be that the parent with the child is now working part-time, can only work part-time because the children are living with them. But later, in 4-5 years' time, when the children are older, maybe don't need to have the other parent around quite so much, they can then increase their hours, go out to work, and so there can be the clean break then. So we frequently have situations where there is maintenance to be paid, but for a fixed term. And that term can be 3, 4, 5 years, and then there'll be a clean break.
And are there any other assets that, anything else that kind of comes into these negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure whether you've noticed, but I've been talking all the way through here about this being the situation in a long marriage where assets have been built up together during the course of that marriage. There are other cases, other situations, where perhaps it's a shorter marriage, sometimes where there are no children at all. But if it's a short marriage, often late in life, perhaps, maybe a second marriage, where people have owned assets before they were married, might have owned a house mortgage-free before they were married, and have brought that into the marriage, which then doesn't last long, lasts 3, 4, 5 years, and then there's a breakdown. Well, would it be fair that those assets that were owned before that marriage, then not built up during the marriage, should they be divided 50-50? And the answer to that is, well, maybe not, but maybe. Again, we go through the same process. We look at the needs of the parties. We look at the needs of any children of the parties, if there are children, and we look at their housing needs. And we look at what they've built, what they have built up together during the marriage, and for the moment, just put to one side those assets that were brought into the marriage, just for the moment. And if what we've built up together during the marriage is enough to meet our financial needs and is enough to meet our housing needs, then maybe we don't need to share those other non-matrimonial assets as well. But we do sometimes, because it may be, particularly in a short marriage, that the assets that we built up during the marriage aren't enough to meet the housing needs of the parties, and in particular, the housing needs of the children. And if that's the case, then we might need to rely on some part of the non-matrimonial assets, not all of it, but just bring them in to the extent that we need to meet those housing needs. And that can apply at both ends of the marriage beforehand, so assets brought in, whether they're business assets or a property brought in before the marriage, but also if we separate, we don't get divorced straight away, and then one of us inherits from our parents or from somebody else, that inheritance, again, has come outside of the time we've been living together. That applies in the same way. That's not matrimonial property. So it can be left out if the matrimonial assets meet our needs, but it can also be brought in if there's a need to do so to meet our housing needs, but only to the extent that we need to meet the housing needs, in particular, of the children.
When we were starting the conversation, and I said advice for adults going into conversations about children, and you said, be an adult. I think it's one of my big take-homes from what we've talked about today, but it really stuck in my mind. Be an adult when talking about children's futures. In terms of other advice you would give to people who are entering this process, what would be your 2 or 3 key bits of advice, having done this with many people over many years? What would you say people really, really need to have top of their mind when they're entering this process to get the best out of it?
I think, first of all, it's going to be to get advice early on from a specialist lawyer solicitor. Because, I mean, and ideally, before you actually enter the process, so that you enter into the process knowing what the likely outcomes are going to be. People very often don't do that, particularly now when we can do the no-fault divorce online ourselves. People will often separate, start their online divorce on the no-fault basis, which is great, by the way, but they then delay getting the advice from a lawyer until a much later stage. And then there's a bit of a shock when they find out what the outcome might actually be. So get advice early on, think about that carefully, think about the needs of the children, think about it not as a battle, but a way of trying to arrange your finances in the best way so that it meets the needs of everybody, the children and both parties going forward, so that you can have a reasonable life in the future. And be focused, be sensible, be open to ideas. Don't think of it as a battle or a fight between yourself and your former spouse, because if you do, there's probably only two people who are going to end up winning out of that, and that's your lawyer and your spouse's lawyer. Because if you can come to an agreement through mediation or discussions or negotiations, then you're going to come to a solution that is fair to everybody, that you're going to be happy with, or at least you're going to be satisfied with, because you've come to that agreement. You're going to save an awful lot of time, an awful lot of pain, and an awful lot of money in legal fees.
Now, if you'd like to find out any more about anything we've been talking about, or you'd like to chat to Neil about something else, you can call Jones Myers in Harrogate on 276 104. That's 276 104.